where he was let go on suspicion of lifting some painkillers. Which was true, though nobody could prove it, so he knows to disconnect the bitch's breathing tube before putting the pillow over her to smother out her life. There. Pillow down. The body is so banged up and hooked up it doesn't even move as its airway is cut off. There's beeping, booping, and bleeping from various instruments, and then the door slides open with a hard slam. He looks up in surprise, seeing that army agent standing right in the doorway. One hand still on the pillow, he goes for the borrowed utility belt. Sanchez steps in and sees a security guard smothering York with a room pillow. He snaps up his Sig Sauer as the guy reaches for his utility belt and pop, pop, pop. The man falls away and crumples to the floor. Shouts and yells come from outside. He steps over to Connie, sees the fake security guard splayed out on the ground like a clumsy starfish, the pillow torn up, and blood starting to pool on the tile. The guard's skin is rapidly graying out. Sanchez turns as a frightened-looking woman nurse peers in, her face pale in shock. He holds up his pistol in his right hand, his badge and identification in the other. "I'm a federal agent," he calls out. "Special Agent Sanchez, United States Army. This man was trying to murder your patient. Please, I need help in here." The nurse ducks back, more yells, shouts out there. He can just imagine the chaos he's caused with the shooting. Sanchez yells, "Your patient is dying. The man here tried to smother her. Please, somebody come in and look at her. Again, I'm a federal agent." A strong woman's voice says, "Put your pistol on the floor, then I'll come in." Sanchez doesn't want to disarm himself, but decides there's no other option. He steps forward, puts his Sig Sauer on the tile. "My weapon's on the floor so you can come in and fix things, okay?" A female nurse in light green scrubs and white sneakers comes in, looks down at the pistol and then goes right over to York's bed, and in a series of quick, fluid movements seems to get everything put back in place. When she's finished, she says, "All right, I've reattached her tube. The man on the floor?" "Not a security guard, I'm sure." She starts to walk over. "His condition?" "Most definitely dead," Sanchez says, and then he scoots over, leans down, and picks up the man's Desert Eagle. The nurse steps back in shock. "You promised?" "That I did," he says, "so you could come in and fix things. Now you can leave." The nurse heads to the door. "Mister, you better be what you say you are, and that man better be an imposter. The ICU out there is filling up with every cop and SWAT team member between here and Atlanta." "I'm sure," Sanchez says. "And if you get a moment, tell them I'm here and I'm not leaving. The only people who get in and touch that woman will be two medical personnel at the same time with full identification." The nurse says, "That must be some woman. Who is she?" Sanchez looks over to the grievously wounded Connie York. "She's my boss," he says. Chapter 80. Lieutenant John Huang wakes up in the hard plastic chair, back aching, mouth dry, with Captain Alan Pierce tapping his shoulder and whispering in his ear. "Somebody's coming," he says. "Wake up." The tone of voice from Pierce has definitely gotten Huang's attention. He sits up, rubbing at his eyes. The place is dimly lit. There are three closed doors, one leading to the jail cells, another going into the police department proper, and a glass one leading outside. Shadows are moving out there. "What's going on?" Huang asks. "Reporters?" "I wish," Pierce says, standing up. "It's 2 a.m. You ever run into journalists at 2 a.m? Most of the time they're sleeping it off or getting drunk in a motel bar complaining about their editors." Huang stands up as well, wiping his face once more. He's hungry and thirsty and his back is aching something awful. The shadows out there are coming closer. Huang says, "No offense, Alan, but I sure wish Major Cook was here." "No offense taken," Pierce says. "God knows what kind of reception he's getting in the stand." A moment slips by. Pierce says, "Get your service weapon out." "What?" "You heard me, Lieutenant. Now." Huang clumsily takes his Sig Sauer out of his side holster, the weight feeling odd and uncomfortable in his hand. Pierce, though, holds his pistol casually, like he's been around weapons all his life. "They're getting closer," Huang says. "Yeah." "Should we tell somebody here?" "Marcy, the jail attendant?" By the time we get real police here, it'll be too late. At least the door is locked, Huang says. Yeah. Two people come to the door, and Huang feels his heart rate thump right along, and the hand holding his pistol is growing warm and moist. A click. The door is unlocked, and a large man and woman come in, both wearing Sullivan County Sheriff's Department uniforms. Pierce says, "Help you, Sheriff Williams?" Huang recognizes the woman, but her whole demeanor and even the look of her face has changed. Earlier she had a hard and confident smile and bearing, like she was in charge of everything around her. Now, her face is pasty and she looks tired, but her eyes are flashing with heat and anger. The other officer is a deputy with Lindsay on his name tag. He is one of the biggest, bulkiest men Huang has ever seen, and Huang can feel violence ready to be released from the man if the sheriff wills it. "Holster your weapons," she says, "now." Huang waits and follows Pierce's lead. "As a courtesy, Sheriff, no problem." Pierce returns his Sig Sauer to his holster, and Huang does the same with his own, though it takes two attempts to do so, making the deputy smile. The sheriff says, "Mind telling me what the hell you two are doing here?" Pierce says, "Keeping an eye on the place." "You don't belong here," she says. "Get out." "I'm afraid that's a non-starter," Pierce says. "We're staying." Deputy Lindsay crosses his large arms. "The sheriff told you to leave. Get out." To Huang's shame, his legs are starting to tremble, but Pierce is still keeping cool. Huang wonders, is this a family thing, learning at a very young age as a black man how to stand your ground in front of the police? Pierce says, "Gee, thanks for the echo, deputy, and we're not leaving. An Army Ranger died here a few days ago. Dr. Huang and I are here to make sure such an event doesn't happen again." "How?" William says. "You're just sitting on your asses in here." Pierce says, "Yes, and tired asses they are, but we're also keeping an eye on who's coming in and who's going out." The deputy looks at the sheriff like he's a Doberman pincher on a leash, begging to be let loose to attack. Sheriff Williams says, "I could have the two of you arrested." "For doing our jobs?" "For trespassing," she says. "The Ralston police chief said we could stay. Marcy, the attendant, even came by to tell us some hours ago that she welcomes the vigilance." "I don't care," Williams says. Pierce laughs, and Huang notes how he's casually moved his hand back to his holstered Sig Sauer. "You want to arrest us, is that right, Sheriff?" Pierce asks. "Restart the whole state's rights versus federal rights argument? Drag us out into that parking lot full of reporters from Savannah, Atlanta, D.C.? Get a whole bit of negative publicity, is that your game plan?" Huang wonders if Pierce is pushing the sheriff too hard in front of her subordinate. This may tip her to do something violent. Something to save face. Williams just remains quiet for some long seconds, then says, "The court hearing for Staff Sergeant Jefferson begins in a matter of hours. An hour after it does, you and everyone else from Quantico better be heading up to the Savannah airport. Come along, Clark." She heads for the door, and Deputy Lindsay shakes his head. "Look at you two, friggin' Chinaman and colored boy thinking you can do anything. You boys can't do squat." Huang wishes he could come back with a good answer, but Pierce does the job. "You're wrong, deputy," he says. "We're not a Chinaman or a colored boy. We're officers in the United States Army." Chapter 81, Afghanistan. After the hour's traveling on the Gardez Highway to FOB Chadwick, just outside Khasta near the village of Pendahar, the Humvee I'm in finally passes through the barriers, checkpoints, and vehicle traps. I've not slept a wink on this long drive, my body tense and nearly trembling, again thinking of what happened to me at another time in another Humvee. This vehicle, however, safely gets into the FOB and stops, and I slowly get out, holding my cane in one hand and my rucksack in the other. There are squat buildings all around us made of metal shipping containers and concrete. The same dull, sandy color. The quiet lieutenant who's in charge of this small convoy comes back to me just as a siren starts wailing, making me feel like I'm in wartime London, 1940. He swears, says, "Come on, hurry up," just as a recorded male voice announces over loudspeakers, "Rocket attack, rocket attack, rocket attack." We move about 10 or so meters before there's a far-off thud that makes the ground quiver, and I follow the lieutenant and others to a blast shelter. Its walls and roof are made of thick concrete, and the open ends of the roof are protected by a blast barrier that we slip through. Just as we get inside, there's another thud, and the six of us, then 10, and then more than a dozen soldiers of different ranks stand inside. I say to the lieutenant, "Can you tell me where Major West is of the 75th Rangers?" The lieutenant says, "I can, but I won't. Not until the all-clear sounds. Otherwise, you might have your head taken off the second you step out." I know I need to wait, but I look at my watch. Time is slipping away, both here and back in Georgia. In the shadowy interior of the blast shelter, a soldier says, "Shit, I guess we pissed somebody off, huh?" Laughter from most of the soldiers in here, but not from me. 15 minutes after the all-clear sounds, I'm in the office of Major Frederico West, Special Troops Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, which is nearly identical to the Ranger office in Bagram. Plywood over a wood frame, homemade shelves, no windows, and locked gray metal filing cabinets. Major West is slim, with close-cropped dark brown hair and brown eyes, wearing a worn ACU. As she moves papers around her gray metal desk, I see her left hand is furrowed with scar tissue. A set of telephones is near her elbow, for both secure and unsecure phone calls, and a military-grade laptop, like the one I'm carrying. She looks exhausted.
"This is where we waste a bunch of time talking about your trip and how you're feeling and do you need something to eat," she begins. "But we don't have time for that crap. One, I've got, well, a shitload of work to get through, and two, your bosses at Quantico want your ass wrapped up in silver ribbon and sent on the next flight home."
I say, "Then why don't I see a roll of silver ribbon on your desk?" West grimaces, begins to talk, waits as one helicopter and then another roars overhead, disturbing the dust that's everywhere in this small office. An M4 automatic rifle is in a weapons rack near the corner.
"You're not being rolled in tape because we Rangers owe you one, and because I'm trying to figure out why a fire team from 4th Battalion is being charged with a crime in Georgia similar to the one they allegedly committed here in country.
In a village called Pendahar." She starts typing on the laptop keyboard.
"Aren't you the informed one?"
I say, "And aren't you the pissy officer? What's the problem, Major? I'm the one about to be brought up on charges and who's just come in to see you after spending nearly a day in the air." Quiet as her fingers work some more.
"No excuse," she says. "Sorry. Been a rotten day in a series of rotten days, not to mention the local mud. You're still sending us 82mm love letters. Can you give me a quick recap of what happened to Staff Sergeant Jefferson and his team in Georgia?"
I say, "A week ago, 7 residents of a rural house in Georgia, including a 2-year-old girl, were murdered in a nighttime attack. The police reports, witnesses, and forensic evidence all led to the Staff Sergeant's team. They were placed under arrest, and my team was tasked to do an investigation."
"What did you and your team learn?"
I paused, then said, "At first, it looked open and shut. Then we found discrepancies in the witness testimony, and those witnesses are now missing. And one of the 4 Rangers committed suicide while in custody." More typing.
"Is your investigation complete?"
"I'm in Afghanistan," I say. "Not yet."
"Yeah, I figured that," she says. "You're wondering about the civilian killings in Pendahar that were linked to those same Rangers before they were sent home, correct? Seeing what happened here in Afghanistan, if it did something to their psyches that led to them repeating the atrocity in Georgia."
"That's been our thought," I say.
"Then let's take a look," she says. "Here's body cam footage we managed to secure of that attack."
West turns the computer around so we can both view the screen as it comes to life. The footage is stamped with running numerals denoting longitude, latitude, and time, and it's in light ghost screen night vision. I hear breathing, murmuring voices. The view comes to a wooden door set against a 1-story small stone house. I see body shapes, and somebody does something to the door. There's a bright flare of light and the thump of an explosion. Yells.
shots being fired. The view is shaky as one room is entered, another, and then another. More gunfire. Robed women scream, hold up their hands. Rapid fire collapses them. A young boy runs into another room, is cut down. I see the flash of weapons. Uniformed men. More screams. The video goes black. My hands and chest feel heavy. Can I see it again, slower? Muted? Sure. I look through the video a second time, spotting the mottled look of the uniforms, one bearing the Ranger tab on a left shoulder, and the weapons from an AK-47 to a pistol, and then I look at Major West's calm yet serious face. Well, she asks, what say you? It's a fake, I say. Those aren't Army Rangers. She nods. Good job for a former NYPD detective. West swivels the computer screen back to her. I don't know what happened in the States, but those Rangers sure as hell didn't kill a house full of civilians in Pendahar. Chapter 82, Afghanistan. She gives me one more stare and says,
just out of curiosity, how did you know it was a fake? To most people, I'm sure it looks pretty damn real.
I try to swallow, fail. My throat is incredibly dry. A jet takes off outside, the noise silencing me longer in this plywood room. When the jet engine sound drifts away, I say, the shootings were real. The casualties look real, but those weren't Army Rangers. The uniforms were wrong. There was a mix of regular ACUs and fatigues of the Afghan National Army. The weapons were wrong, too. I saw an AK-47 and what looked to be a Russian pistol, maybe a Tokarev. She slightly smiles.
But one of the shooters was wearing a Ranger tab.
Yes, I say, but you and I both know that Rangers don't wear any unit patches in the field. And the camera froze there for a second too long, like whoever was doing the taping wanted to make a statement.
Good job, Major.
What's the story then? A setup?
That's what we're thinking, she says.
Commit an atrocity, put it up on YouTube or other social media. Blame the Rangers and the Crusader unbelievers defiling this holy land, blah, blah, blah.
Some unlucky innocents got caught in a crossfire organized by the local Taliban.
But we were lucky to have intercepted the video before it was spread around too much. Oh, there were rumblings in the start of an official investigation, which I'm closing out when you go out that door. But the Rangers were innocent. We even showed the video at a local tribal Loya Jirga, and the tribal leaders are on board that the army didn't do it. But the Rangers are accused of doing the same thing stateside.
Yeah, she says. That's a puzzle, isn't it?
She looks down at her notes and says,
hold on, you said the civilians who were killed in Georgia, some of them were truck dealers. How far up did they go, big-time players?
I shake my head. Some weed, some crystal meth, and fentanyl, strictly small-time.
Too bad. Well, good, I suppose. But I was thinking if they were players, and they were involved in something to do with opiates, and Afghanistan being the leading cultivator of the same, with a lot of flights going back to the States, there could be some sort of connection.
Not with that group, I say. Do you have any additional information on Major Frank Moore, the 4th Battalion's executive officer? West shakes her head.
He was supposed to have been deployed a couple of days back when the 4th Battalion left Hunter Army Airfield, but he was unable to be located. Then Savannah cops pulled him out of the local river back there. Bullet round right to the face. They're running the investigation, but I was able to learn that he was probably killed after meeting with Staff Sergeant Jefferson, who's being held in a local jail, yes?
Ralston, I say. He's in a jail in Ralston.
And you tell me he's planning to plead guilty to those shootings?
I check my watch, run the difference in time in my mind, and say, in about 8 hours, yeah.
Hell of a thing to do if he's not guilty, but he's taking the rap anyway.
He's doing that, but the two surviving members of his team will go free. That's the deal. They don't face a trial, and he pleads guilty, takes whatever sentence comes his way. Wes ponders this before I add, you Ranger guys are tough and loyal.
Like you wouldn't believe, she says.
You think Staff Sergeant Jefferson would plead guilty to something he didn't do to see his guys get cut loose?
He'd have to have one hell of a good reason, she says.
Something comes to me and I say, hold on. This alleged massacre in Pendahar. I heard that was the reason they were sent home ahead of schedule, but you've told me that it was pretty suspicious right from the start.
West carefully says, it was.
But why send them home on such flimsy evidence?
Good question.
She doesn't say any more, and I quickly realize how to fill in the blanks. They weren't assigned to a local ranger company. They were sheep-dipped, borrowed by the CIA.
Her words are even more careful. That's what I heard.
What did they do for the CIA?
High-value target raids, I'm sure, she says. Staff Sergeant Jefferson and his fire team were quite experienced in those types of raids. The CIA has a paramilitary unit, the Special Activities Division. I have a ranger friend who's worked with them, but they don't have as much field experience as some ranger units.
The CIA was controlling them, I say. Why did the CIA send them home ahead of their deployment schedule? This house raid, the killing of civilians, it was just an excuse, a cover story.
Maybe, she says. You'll have to talk to the CIA about that.
All right, where are they? I ask. I'll go ahead and do just that.
West says, it'll be a waste of time. You'd want to talk to the field officer handling those raids, and he's been transferred.
Who's the officer?
Fellow named Kurtz, though God knows if that's his real name. He's at Observation Post Conrad.
Where's that?
West points to her door. About 10 clicks that way, up in the mountains between here and Pakistan. Only way up there is by helicopter.
Can you get me there? Her phone rings and she holds up a finger. She takes the call.
West, and seems to listen for a moment, then says, thanks for the heads up, Sergeant Major.
West hangs up the phone, shakes her head.
You know better than that, Major Cook. We don't have any air assets. We get assigned them for a planned and specific mission, and I'm not in a position to do that, sorry.
Major West, I say, the answer to whatever the hell is going on with those rangers is up there with that CIA officer. One ranger is dead. Another is facing life imprisonment for murders he might not have committed. Are you going to let that staff sergeant go to prison for life, probably face execution? Is that what you're saying?
Her brown eyes flash at me with anger. What I'm saying is that I can't make up a manifest and put your name on it, Major Cook, because I've just been told that there's an MP unit about 20 minutes out coming here looking for you.
Shit, I think. Shit. Sorry, I say.
Her face calms down. You're former NYPD, right?
That's right, I say, 19 years in.
She nods and says, go up 2 compounds. That's where the night stalkers hang out. There's a warrant officer there named Salucci. You might have some luck with him, but no guarantees. I'll walk you over, see that you get in.
I stand up, grab my rucksack. Thanks, Major.
Good luck, Major Cook,
she says as she too stands.
Because you're certainly going to need it.
The sirens start up again, and the steady, calm male voice of the recording comes back. Rocket attack, rocket attack, rocket attack.
Chapter 83, Afghanistan. The Night Stalkers is the name of the Army's 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment. Probably pound for pound the bravest and craziest helicopter pilots in the world. Responsible for operations in Panama, Yemen, Iraq, and Afghanistan, along with the raid that took out Osama bin Laden, they're the Army aviators called upon to perform the most hazardous and nearly impossible missions. Their compound is just a short walk from Major West's, and while some of the soldiers and civilian personnel seem a bit jumpy after the 2 recent mortar attacks, the same isn't true for the Night Stalkers, some of whom I find outdoors after Major West escorts me there. I come upon a rest area for these aviators set outside 3 one-story metal and wood shacks. Beyond a concrete block wall and coils of razor wire, their modified and exceptional helicopters of choice are lined up. 2 rotor transport MH-47s with extended fuel booms up front, Blackhawks for a variety of missions, and the much smaller 2 crew little birds used for reconnaissance and close combat and support.
Nearby is a gravel-covered area with weightlifting equipment, punching bags, and half a dozen wooden picnic tables, where laughing and confident men are having late-morning coffee and sausage, eggs, and pancakes on styrofoam plates. They're dressed in jeans, cut-off sweatshirts, hoodies, and vests, most wearing ball caps. The wind is steady, meaning they have to hold on tight to their food and drink. As I approach the nearest table, I'm given a quick look by the men, and then they go back to their stories and breakfasts. I can see why I got the quick look. I might be an army officer, but I'm not one of them, so I don't count. About then, I'm ready to believe them. I say, I'm looking for a guy named Salucci. Is he around? One of the aviators with a close-cropped black beard and wearing sunglasses, a tattered Red Sox baseball cap on his head, says, "What's up, Major?" "I just need to talk to him," I say. "Can you point him out?" The aviator says, "Over there on the left. The laughing asshole wearing the Yankees cap." "Thanks." I go over to the table where he's sitting, laughing indeed, wearing the offending black and white Yankees cap and a black fleece jacket. Salucci looks to be in his early 30s, muscular with a happy-looking red face that can probably go from joy to deadly anger in seconds. "Excuse me," I ask. "Salucci?" The other three guys laugh, and Salucci says, "The same, Major. Chief Warrant Officer Carmine Salucci, what can I do for you?" "I was hoping I could talk to you," I say, "in private." His grin doesn't waver. "Mind if I ask why, sir?" I take out my identification, display it for him. "I'm with the CID, does that answer your question?" As one, his three breakfast mates go, "Ooh, the Looch is in trouble, the Looch is in trouble," and he says something profane to them. They pick up their coffee and plates and leave us alone as I sit down across from him. "Do I need representation?" he asks. "You looking to jam me up?" "No, not at all," I say, smelling the sausages and pancakes still before him, my stomach grumbling from not quite remembering the last time I ate. "Then what's this about?" he asks. His smile is still there, but there's wariness behind those sharp brown eyes. "I need transport," I say. He says, "This is a hell of a way to make a request. You got the paperwork, push it through channels." "I don't have any paperwork." That takes him aback and he laughs. "What, you think me and the guys here are flying a taxi service, Major? Where are you looking to go?" "Observation Post Conrad," I say. "It's up in the nearest mountain range, that's all I know." He stares at me and starts laughing again. "OP Conrad? For real? Why not Mars while you're at it?" "Remote, then?" He shakes his head, takes off his Yankees cap, scratches at his nearly bald head. "Yeah, remote as hell, and the place is legendary, and not in a good way. There's one American up there, a guy named Kurtz," I interrupt. The cap goes back on. "That's right, Kurtz, like Brando in the Vietnam movie. Far away from whatever passes for civilization, he's up there with a group of Pashtun tribesmen who are loyal to him and their tribe and nothing else." "What do they do up there?" "Whatever the hell they want," he says. "Why do you need to see him?" "I need to talk to him about an investigation I'm conducting. Go through channels, get the paperwork. Hell, I wouldn't mind taking a trip up there. That's some ass-puckering flying." "I don't have time," I say. "I need to talk to him today." Another shake of his head. "You think you can get Kurtz to answer your questions? You know he's agency, right? Won't talk to anyone. Unless you have a fistful of Hershey bars." Salucci notices my confused expression and repeats himself. "Yeah, Hershey bars. And not the ones with the almonds. One guy who went up there 6 months ago for a supply run, even a scheduled one, told me he couldn't even drop his load until Kurtz got his Hershey bars. Tell me, Major, you got some Hershey bars in your ruck?" "No." "Then we're just wasting each other's time. Sorry, Major, wish I could help." He starts to get up from the picnic table and I say, "Brooklyn?" Salucci says, "Nope, Queens, through and through." "My bad," I say, "I'm from Staten Island." He gathers up his trash. "No kidding, how did you end up in CID?
"NYPD, I say. "Detective Second Class, Midtown South. I was in the reserves and decided to stick around after I got injured from an IED.
"Well, good for you. Bet some days you wish you stayed home."
I nod. Some days. Sorry, gotta run, Major. One last chance. Get out of jail free card. He pauses as he puts a crumpled brown paper napkin on his plate. What? I say, you get me up there to see Kurtz. I'll make it so that you don't get another speeding ticket, parking ticket, or any other motor vehicle violation for a year, starting when you get back home. That gets his attention. You got that kind of pull? Probably not, I think. I'm serious. I can tell, he says. Man, you must really want to go up there bad. I do. He crumples everything up in his two strong hands. Major, sorry, no can do. That's way out of bounds and you know it. Salucci goes to a rusty 55-gallon metal drum near a set of weights, drops in his trash, and I rub at my face in turn just as two soldiers come in from the other side wearing military police brassards on their left arms. Looking for me, I'm sure. Chapter 84, Afghanistan. As casually as I can, I get up from the picnic table, leaving my cane behind, too blatant a sign of who I am, and I follow Salucci and two other warrant officers as they walk back into the nearest building. The three of them are laughing and joking and don't notice me following them, and I hope the two MPs on the other side of the compound are doing the same thing. They pass through a swinging plywood door and I'm in a ready room with couches, chairs, large-scale maps pinned up on the wall, flags from various states and pennants from every type of sports team imaginable. Some night stalkers are seated, thumbing through magazines or playing with handheld video games. Where to go? Anywhere, I think, anywhere away from that door the MPs will eventually come through. Once they get to me, check my ID, it's done. Over. And what's going on back in Georgia? 5 times since I left Bagram, I called Connie on my Iridium, and 5 times there was no answer. Once or twice, I could believe it was due to some satellite problem or solar flare interference, but not 5 times. I don't like it, knowing she's back there, riding herd on my crew, with a hostile and criminal county sheriff keeping an eye on everything, and her going to a meeting with a guy who says he knows the truth about the massacre. I go down a narrow corridor with a concrete floor, more plywood doors and cubicles on it, and the smell is of aviation fuel, sweat, and ill-washed clothes. The smell is also called fan, for feet, ass, and nuts. The corridor opens into an operations center with computer screens, communications equipment, radios, secure telephones, and more maps and photographs up on the walls. Boy, I really don't belong here. An officer with a colonel's rank starts to get up and say something, and I turn around and take 3 quick steps, nearly knocking down Chief Warrant Officer Carmine Salucci, who's carrying a tan plastic bag in his right hand. He laughs. Hey, Major, there are 2 MPs out there looking for a Major Cook who's using a cane. What a coincidence, huh? I say, you see me with a cane? No, but the MPs will probably go beyond just that, he says. By the way, 2 years. What? He takes my upper arm, starts leading me away from the inquisitive colonel back in the operations center. You give me what you promised back there, except it's for 2 years, not 1. Deal. And it includes my girlfriend. You're pushing it, Salucci. He stops, opens the plastic bag, and lets me look inside. A pile of Hershey's chocolate bars in their familiar dark brown packages with gray lettering. You need to pay to get in. I don't hesitate. Your girlfriend, too. He closes up the bag. Good, he says. Just don't tell the wife. Come on. But orders, I say. Paperwork. What changed? Oh, a sweet coincidence, he says. One of the little birds in my company just finished a maintenance cycle. Somebody needs to take it up for a test flight, make sure the oil doesn't leak or a screw doesn't fall off. How does that sound? Sounds great, I say. He takes me through a door to the outside and says, we'll be heading out in about an hour after I do a pre-flight check and get our gear together. By the way, what kind of investigation are you doing? You need to talk to Kurtz about it. A Ranger Staff Sergeant, I say. He's up on murder charges, intends to plead guilty later today. I don't think he did it. I hope Kurtz will back me up on this. Where's the Ranger being held? Georgia, I say. and I think he's in danger. Salucci whistles. Once spent 6 months in Georgia training some of their pilots. Young and scared, and I'd be scared too with Russia and its shit-ass military right next door. Not that Georgia, I say as we approach a set of tents. The one back in the States. Oh, he says. That Georgia. Man, that could be worse. I say, it certainly could. Another glance at my watch. Time is still slipping away, and I'm so far away from being where I need to be.
Chapter 85. For the past few minutes, dogs have been barking as Sheriff Emma Williams maneuvers her cruiser down the narrow, bumpy dirt road a few hours before sunrise, on this day she has to control from start to finish. The dirt road widens and ends in a wide spot of dirt and gravel where half a dozen ATVs, four battered pickup trucks with large muddy tires, and one bright blue and highly polished Mercedes-Benz A-Class sedan are parked. There are also three trailers set in a semicircle, and another one is farther away. Even at this time of the morning, there are lights on in every trailer because the chained hound dogs back there make for an effective early warning system. There's also a heavy scent of nail polish remover, and as Williams gets out of her cruiser, then puts on her hat, she knows that not a single ounce of nail polish exists in these four trailers. She leaves the cruiser's engine running, as well as keeps the headlights on. The wind comes up and the smell doesn't lessen, because that farther trailer is a meth lab. And in one random spasm of intelligence, the family that operates the lab made sure it was far enough away so that if it exploded, the rest of this isolated compound wouldn't go up as well. Two large barns are visible in the distance through a stand of trees, which they use to dry their marijuana harvests.
Tolliver, she yells. You up in there?
Dogs bark inside, and then the door to the closest trailer opens up and a tall, heavy-set man stumbles out, tying tight the string around his dirty gray sweatpants. He also has on an Atlanta Braves tank top. His upper arms are hairy and flabby and quiver as he comes toward the cruiser. You're not Hiram, she says.
Nope, he says, yawning, rubbing at the back of his head. I'm his nephew, Boyd.
Boyd, she says. I don't think we've met.
No, ma'am, he says, shielding his eyes with a beefy hand. Look, can you switch off those headlights?
No, William says. What did your uncle tell you to do?
He coughs, scratches at his stomach.
He told me to do whatever you wanted. No questions, no talk back.
That's a hell of an open ticket, you know.
Uncle Hiram, he says he'd make it good for me. Excuse me.
Boyd turns and clears his lungs, spits twice on the dirt. Turning back, he wipes a hand across his mouth and says,
What do you need, Sheriff?
She says, You're coming with me to the county jail. You're going to be placed in a cell. Later this morning, maybe just before noon or somewhere close to that, a prisoner is going to be put in that cell. From her left pants pocket, she takes out a slim knife. After he's placed in there with you, you're going to slit his throat with this.
She holds out the knife and he takes it.
Gosh, ma'am, that's pretty cold, you know? Killing a man I don't know, I don't have a grudge against.
He's an uppity nigger that thinks he's better than you.
Oh,
he says, taking the blade, sliding it into the pocket of his sweatpants.
That's okay, then.
Good.
But, ma'am?
Yes.
How do I get there? I mean, there's no warrants or anything out there on me. Ma'am?
William smiles. This is going to be all right.
Boyd, come over here and knock off my hat, okay?
Okay.
Boyd comes over, knocks off her hat.
Now, she says, pick it up.
Yes, ma'am.
He picks up her hat and hands it over and she puts it back on. She grabs his wrist, turns him around, and quickly and efficiently puts on the handcuffs.
Boyd Tolliver, I'm placing you under arrest for assaulting a law enforcement officer, she says.
Ma'am.
Yes.
My wrists are sore from chopping wood yesterday. Mind not putting on the cuffs too tight? Williams leads him back to her cruiser.
Not at all, she says.
Chapter 86. Captain Alan Pierce gets up from his chair and kicks at Lieutenant John Huang's legs. For the past couple of hours, Huang has tried to sleep with three chairs pushed together, and that hasn't gone well, with Huang falling twice onto the floor. Huang jerks awake.
What's up?
Circus is about to start, Pierce says, looking at the crowd suddenly moving toward the door of the jailhouse. A sheriff's van just pulled in.
Huang yawns, stretches, winces. What's our job?
Pierce checks his service weapon. Make sure the staff sergeant gets to the courthouse without a Jack Ruby getting in the way. The door flings open and Deputy Sheriff Clark Lindsay comes in, looking the same as he did a few hours ago, except now he's wearing a bullet-resistant vest over his uniform, with yellow letters denoting Sullivan County Sheriff in a stylized badge underneath. Two other deputies follow him, carrying shotguns. Pierce says, Good morning, Deputy Clark. Taking time away from ironing your white sheets to play bus driver? Clark comes up close to Pierce, and Pierce doesn't budge an inch. Clark grins.
Boy, one of these days you're gonna leave, and I'm gonna stay right here, and Sullivan County will get right back to where it belongs.
Pierce says, In 1950?
No, he says, where people mind their business. Now get out of my way. Me and my boys got work to do.
No problem, Pierce says, just as the Ralston police chief Richard Kane comes in carrying a clipboard.
Clark,
the chief says, looking worn down, his thick mustache drooping.
Glad to see you here. Let's get this taken care of so we can get back to normal.
The chief takes out a key set, unlocks the door leading into the cell area, and the three deputies walk in. Pierce follows as well, with Huang right behind him. Deputy Lindsay sees this and says,
Hey, Chief, those army guys shouldn't be here. Keep them out.
Pierce won't let the chief answer and says, Let us in, Chief. You don't want an accident or anything untoward to happen to the staff sergeant right now, do you? Dr. Huang and I will just be witnesses representing the U.S. Army. Deputy Lindsay says,
Dick, I'm telling you, keep those soldier boys out.
Well,
Chief Kane starts. Pierce is pleased when Huang jumps in.
Chief Kane. This is your facility, correct? Not the county sheriff's, am I right? That means only you have the authority here, not Deputy Lindsay.
The chief has a sly smile on his face, like after months of losing at poker with the deputy, he's about to win this hand.
That's right. Come on, Clark. It'll only take a few minutes.
The deputy says, I won't forget this, Dick. And neither will the sheriff.
Pierce says, Fine, none of us will forget it. We'll all be Mensa candidates later today. After you, Chief. The small procession goes down the concrete hallway past two interview rooms and then to the cells. The three Army Rangers are standing straight and tall, hands right beside their legs. Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson steps close to the bars.
Nice group of visitors, he says. What a lucky guy I must be.
Deputy Lindsay steps forward and says,
Caleb Jefferson, my deputies and I are here to transport you to the Sullivan County Superior Courthouse. Put your hands through the cell door, we'll get you cuffed and on your way.
Pierce sees Jefferson's dark eyes narrow.
What about my guys? Corporal Barnes and Specialist Ruiz. That was part of the deal, they go free.
Chief Kane speaks up.
Not a problem, Staff Sergeant. I got a phone call a few minutes ago from the District Attorney, Mr. Slate. He says your men will be released by the end of the day today. Seems there's so much going on at the courthouse, he just can't get away at the moment.
Jefferson doesn't say a word, but quickly looks over at the other two rangers.
All right, he says. Chief, I'm holding you responsible for my guy's safety and freedom. Just make sure it happens.
Deputy Lindsay says,
Boy, you threatening the police, chief?
No, he says, thrusting his hands through the cell door opening. Not making a threat, just making sure there's no misunderstanding down the road.
Lindsay takes handcuffs from his duty belt, snaps them shut around Jefferson's wrists.
Step back now.
Jefferson takes three steps back and Chief Kane unlocks the cell door, swings it open.
Jefferson steps forward and the other two rangers snap to attention.
You take care, Sergeant, Barnes says.
We got your back, Sergeant,
Ruiz says.
As the procession makes its way out of the cell area, Chief Kane says to no one in particular,
That was weird. I thought those two other fellas, I thought they were going to give him a salute.
Pierce says, That's Hollywood bullshit. Nobody gives a salute indoors, and nobody gives a salute as a prisoner.
Oh, the chief says.
Yeah, Pierce says. This is reality. As real as it gets.
Chapter 87. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is sitting in a corner of Trauma Room 2 with a grievously injured Special Agent Connie York in a hospital bed and one dead assailant sprawled out on the floor. Nothing you really see in cop TV shows or movies, but after just a few minutes, a freshly shot body starts to smell when certain muscles relax and let loose body waste, and now it's been hours and long hours at that. Sanchez is on the floor with a chair and a small cabinet dragged in front to offer some mode of protection. He's impressed that he's managed to stay awake during the night. A few hours ago, it looked like a small black snake was about to come into the room, but Sanchez knew it was a flexible optic surveillance device checking out the situation. He resisted an urge to give it a cheery wave. Now suddenly a strong male voice comes from the outside corridor.
Hello, the room?
Sanchez says,
Hello, right back.
The man says,
I'm Lieutenant Harry Leitner, Savannah Police Department. Who am I talking to?
Special Agent Manuel Sanchez, U.S. Army CID, he says. Nice to make your acquaintance.
Same here, the Savannah officer replies. We've got quite the situation here, don't we?
That's true, amigo, Sanchez says.
You seem pretty concerned about Agent York's safety.
Yep.
You said earlier that you'd only allow two medical personnel at a time into the room to check on Agent York, Leitner says.
Roger that, Sanchez says.
You know we can't allow that, not with you holding a weapon and having discharged it.
Sanchez doesn't know much about emergency medicine, but in looking up at the equipment stationed near York, nothing seems to be in the red or sounding off an alarm.
Ah, gee, Lieutenant, Sanchez says. Just when I was beginning to establish a bond of trust with you, you have to go ahead and spoil it by insulting me. I didn't discharge my service weapon. I shot a guy trying to murder my boss. And you know, and I know, he doesn't work for the hospital. I bet you've done a head count of the hospital's security staff, and there isn't one missing.
Sanchez waits for a reply, and then the lieutenant says,
You know, this yelling back and forth, it sure is cumbersome. How about I slide in a portable phone we can talk easier?
Sanchez laughs.
Sure. A portable phone with a hidden microphone and camera or a flashbang grenade or a tear gas canister. Not going to happen, Lieutenant.
He takes out his iPhone, sends off a quick text message. He doesn't think he's going to have much more time in here and wants to make things clear to Pierce and Huang as this day proceeds.
All right, the lieutenant says. Can we get you anything in the meantime, Agent Sanchez? Water, juice, something to eat?
He takes another sniff. Damn, is it getting foul in here.
I want two cops, he says.
What?
Two cops, Sanchez says.
Dressed in nothing except their underwear. No shoes, no socks, nothing. They come in with hands out and they slowly turn around and lower their shorts so I know they're not concealing anything. Got it?
The Savannah lieutenant says.
Are you joking, Agent Sanchez? You can't be serious.
Oh, serious indeed, he says. Those two cops come in, just as I say, and they take out the dead guy. That gives you a chance to fingerprint him, do an ID, find out why he tried to kill my boss. How does that sound?
Sanchez looks at his iPhone. In the upper left-hand portion of the screen, small letters now announce, where they didn't before, no service. The cops are blocking his cell phone. No matter. Sanchez settles in for a long wait and looks up to York and says, Hang in there, boss. We need to know what you know.
Captain Alan Pierce is driving their rental Ford sedan right behind the dark brown van of the Sullivan County Sheriff's Department when his phone chimes and so does Huang's.
He says, "What's up, John? Who's trying to talk to us? The Atlanta Journal-Constitution?" Huang holds his phone close to his face.
"It's from Sanchez."
"What does it say?"
"It says, still guarding York. Pierce in charge. Protect the Rangers."
"Text him back."
"And tell him what?"
Pierce takes a look in the rearview mirror, sees the line of rented cars and vans belonging to the news media streaming behind them like some ghoulish parade. "Tell him message received," Pierce says. "Nothing else. Poor guy's got his hands full." Huang's fingers start working on the handheld screen.
"So do we. Shit, why haven't we heard from Major Cook?"
Pierce says. "Maybe he's gotten held up in some carpet bazaar." "Forget Cook for the moment, John. We're on our own." Gus Milner is a maintenance worker and transport assistant at the Memorial Health University Medical Center, and he's having a busy day. When the ER is busy, he's busy, and right now he's carrying a heavy plastic bag that holds the belongings of a female gunshot victim who was admitted yesterday. There was some sort of foul-up yesterday in delivering this bag, so he needs to bring the bag up to the ICU's nurse's station. Afterward, there's a restroom on the third floor that needs attention. He's alone in an elevator, going up, when something starts ringing in the bag. It keeps ringing. He opens the bag, looks inside. Black slacks, shoes, and a heavy phone with a big keypad and a thick, stubby antenna. Not a type of cell phone he's ever seen. What to do? Answer it. He closes the bag, and when he gets to the right floor for the ICU, it stops ringing. Good. Last month, one of his buds got shit-canned for answering some patient's phone in a bag of possessions like this, and Gus isn't about to lose his job over something so simple and silly.
Chapter 88. Afghanistan. I switch off my Iridium phone and put it back in my rucksack. Chief Warrant Officer Saluji is standing to the right of the Little Bird helicopter and waves me forward. It's windy out on the airstrip, hitting us with dust and gravel.
"No answer, Major?"
"None," I say, walking to him as best as I can without my cane, rucksack in my right hand. I'm dressed in a dark green flight suit, carrying an oversized crash helmet in my left hand. He shrugs.
"Happens sometimes. The signals don't go through. Cosmic rays, sunspots, the atmospherics around here are pretty strange. Here, I'll take your bag."
Saluchi grabs it with little effort, tosses it into the rear, which is used for storage. I go to climb in and hesitate, my left leg screaming at me how stupid this is, and then Saluchi says,
"Here you go."
He grabs two fistfuls of my flight suit fabric and pushes me in, the fabric from the one-piece suit jamming into a very sensitive area, and I sit down in the small, tight canvas seat. Saluchi helps strap me in and then walks around the bubble glass front, eases himself into the pilot's seat.
"Put your helmet on. Let's get the comms set up so we can chat with each other."
He helps me put the borrowed helmet on, adjusts the mic in front, hooks up the communications cable. I feel like I'm being put into a carnival ride by some smug, traveling carny who secretly hopes I piss myself when the ride ends. After he buckles himself in, Saluchi starts working the switches and I try to take it all in. There's a control stick in front of me with an incidental one in front of Saluchi. Large pedals are on the floor and I keep my feet away from them. Between us is a large console with a square screen and round dials, and I think I recognize a compass, and that's about it. Saluchi adjusts something and his voice crackles through the helmet's earphones.
"Hear me, Major?"
I adjust the mic in front of my mouth and say, "Just fine, Chief."
"Good," he says.
Overhead, the engine starts to whine and he says,
"Okay, quick safety demo before we get airborne. If we're up there and I get hit or disabled so you're the only one conscious, this is what you're going to do, okay? Pay attention."
Earlier I was warm in my borrowed flight suit, but now I'm near shivering with apprehension. "Paying attention, Chief."
"Good," he says. "If I'm slumped over and you can't revive me and we're heading to the ground, you unsnap your harness here, here, and here," he slaps at my torso, "and slip off your helmet quick as you can and do your best to kiss your ass goodbye before we hit."
He laughs and maneuvers the control stick in front of him.
the collective control by his seat, and working the pedals, he lifts us off from FOB Chadwick. I've flown other times in helicopters, military and NYPD, and they are Cadillacs compared to the Little Bird, which feels like a Volkswagen Beetle with helicopter blades overhead. Salucci turns another dial and I can hear him broadcast.
Tower, this is November Sierra 4, he says. Clear for departure to the south?
Roger that, November Sierra 4,
comes the female voice of the airstrip's flight controller.
You are clear.
He takes us up and my stomach does a few loop-de-loops, for in front of us is a huge plexiglass bubble, which gives me the feeling that at any moment I could slide out of my seat and break through the window. The fading afternoon sunlight flickers overhead from the spinning blades casting shadows over the curved bubble. The control stick in front of me moves whenever Salucci moves his stick. I swallow twice and look at Salucci, who smiles at my discomfort and gives me a thumbs up.
Doing all right, Major?
He asks, voice strong and confident through the earphones. I swallow again.
Chief, I know you're an elite flyer. The Army knows you're an elite flyer. And so does everyone else in the Night Stalkers. Just a favor, all right?
What's that, Major?
I say, please don't feel like you have to prove anything to me. Let's just skip that step.
A laugh comes through.
Roger that, Major.
It doesn't take long for us to leave the flat plain that holds the city of Khost and FOB Chadwick. The southern part of the Hindu Kush Range, separating Afghanistan from Pakistan, rises straight up before us, left to right, huge stony peaks riven with valleys and ravines containing trees and small forests. Twice I spot a small village, stone and brick homes built on the steep slopes of the lower range.
Pretty remote down there, ain't it? Salucci says.
It looks like the ends of the earth.
He says, maybe so, but there are eyes on us down there, tracking us. Right now, cell phones and handheld radios are ringing in every direction for about 15 or 20 clicks, saying the Americans are coming.
You ever get shot at?
All the time, Major, all the time, he says. But usually we're moving too fast. The T-men love to track the Chinooks and hit them when they're landing or taking off. That's one of the good things about the Little Birds.
Higher and higher we go, my ears popping, and Salucci says,
this is the God's honest truth, Major, but last year I inserted a team into the real remote and deep valley, the kind of place where it looks like you have to pipe in the sunshine. And the villagers there, they thought we were the Russians. Can you believe that?
I say, must be true if you say it. Could have been worse, though.
How?
They could have thought you were British.
That earns me a laugh from my pilot as we continue to climb into the ragged mountains.
In less than 15 minutes, Salucci tilts us as he turns to the left and he says,
okay, Major, there it is. OP Conrad, straight ahead.
I look and see just a flat peak with tumbled rocks, stunted trees, and brush.
Where?
You'll see soon enough,
he says, and then he starts transmitting and I hear his voice.
Oscar Papa Charlie, this is November Sierra 4, November Sierra 4. Do you copy?
The helicopter starts to descend.
Oscar Papa Charlie, this is November Sierra 4, inbound. Do you copy?
I think I see shapes appear. Then a satellite dish. Another one, a set of antennas. A cleared, rocky space about half the size of a basketball court.
Oscar Papa Charlie, November Sierra 4 calling. We are inbound. Do you copy?
I say, it doesn't look like anyone's home.
Ah, they're home all right, Salucci says. But maybe they're too busy to chat. Okay, Major, unsnap your straps, drop your crash helmet, get ready to hop out. I'll be back in 20.
It feels like a cold fist has just punched my gut. You're not staying with me? He curses.
Are you nuts? How long do you think me and my little bird will last if I stay up there like a goddamn fly on a tabletop?
The Mooj will start dropping in mortar rounds in about 90 seconds. The rocky surface rushes up.
Nope, he goes on. I'll be back in 20 minutes to pick you up, head back to the FOB. Hope you can get your business done in that amount of time. You got a gold pass for one round trip, and that's it.
I tense up because at our rate of descent, my mind is screaming at me that we're going to crash. But being the expert he is, Chief Salucci works the controls and flares us up, the twin landing skids barely touching the ground. He slaps me on the shoulder.
Go! Get the hell moving before I get a mortar round in my lap!
I get the straps and buckles undone, reach behind me, get my rucksack, open the side door, and toss the rucksack out. I take off the borrowed crash helmet and shift and drop to the ground, making sure I land on my good leg. And I close my eyes and hold my breath as I'm engulfed in a whirling cloud of dust and kicked up small rocks. With a humming roar, the little bird lifts off and then dips into a ravine, until all I hear is the dimming noise of the engine. Then it pops back up into view, and I spot Salucci as he hugs the contours of the nearest ridge, waggling back and forth like he finally wants to show off. Fair enough. I grab my rucksack and start toward the hidden bunkers of OP Conrad. I notice faded white PVC tubes stuck in the dirt, homemade urinals, and there is netting hanging up and dirt berms and HESCO barriers made of metal webbing and about the size of large freezers filled with rocks and dirt. There are antennas and satellite dishes, and one, then two, then four men emerge from a dirt entrance, like spelunkers coming up after being lost for a month. Hey, I say. The four men come closer, and now I understand why Salucci couldn't raise the outpost's radio. The four men are wiry, tall, bearded, and wearing their traditional sandals, cotton pants, sheepskin vests, and flat wool hats of Afghan villagers. And fighters. All are carrying AK-47s with belts and pouches around their skinny waists. With horror, I realize that at some recent point the Taliban must have overrun this place. I drop my rucksack on the ground, hold out my hands. I have my service weapon holstered at my side, but going for it would be an instant death sentence. And I say, "Hey, does anyone..." The closest one yells something I don't understand and then hits me in the stomach with the butt of his AK-47.
Chapter 89. The hearing room in the Sullivan County Superior Courthouse is packed, with not a single seat available along the two sets of four long wooden benches. Before the benches is a wooden bar with a swinging gate, and to the left is the juror's box, which is empty. Captain Alan Pierce and Dr. John Huang are standing against a wall near the doors leading into the outer hall. Only by showing their CID badges and appealing to the patriotism of the courthouse attendants were they able to get in. Huang says, "What a circus." Pierce doesn't say a word, just takes it all in. Across from the empty jury box are two tables and sets of chairs. One table is occupied by District Attorney Cornelius Slate, sitting slumped in his chair. The other table and chairs are empty, and that's where Pierce expects Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson to show up in a few minutes. At the other side of the enclosure is a witness booth, the raised bench for the judge, also empty, and another booth that looks to be occupied by an older African-American woman, probably the court clerk. Two male uniformed court attendants stand by the judge's bench. Huang nudges him with an elbow.
"Look, over there. Do you see who has a prime seat?"
Pierce spots Sheriff Emma Williams sitting in the first row, with her campaign hat in her lap, and she's laughing and whispering to everyone near her. Huang says,
"She looks happier than hell. Why is that?"
Sheriff Emma Williams checks her watch. In a few minutes, that old fool Judge Howell Rollins will come in, hopefully not stumbling after his usual breakfast of two Bloody Marys, and get this show on the road. She smiles as she takes in all of her people in the courtroom and doesn't even break her smile at seeing those two sad-looking army folks standing over there against the wall, like theater-goers who were promised orchestra seats and now are forced to stand throughout the show. And what a show today promises to be. Behind this courthouse is the Sullivan County Jail, and that place is hers. Boyd Tolliver is in a two-person holding cell, and when that double-crossing piece of shit Staff Sergeant Jefferson pleads guilty and is sent back there, in preparation for being transferred to a state prison, well, the official story will be that he attacked this poor citizen out of rage, and said citizen had to defend himself. The other two will be taken care of later, tonight, or early tomorrow morning. Of that, she has no doubt. And the woman CID agent who nearly got her head blown off, Williams heard late last night from a nurse at the hospital that she's in a coma and probably won't make it. She rubs at a healing scratch on her hand. Hell, even those two redneck clowns she put down a couple of days back near Hunter Army Airfield haven't yet been reported missing. Then, Tuesday, election day, and the day after, she'll start packing her bags. Williams scans the room, seeing her people. Will Fletcher, who took out a loan from her 4 years back when his dump trucks needed repair and will be paying off the loan for another 3 years. Moss Gray, who refused to give her a cut of his shine business and whose two sons are now doing time over in Georgia State Prison. Ray Cass, who illegally dumps waste oil and gasoline from his three service stations in the local state forest, and who is going to do a favor for the sheriff late tonight by disabling the bay doors for the Ralston Volunteer Fire Department so they can't respond when an electrical fire breaks out at the Ralston jail, incinerating the poor prisoners incarcerated there. Just the two, of course. But that will be enough. Williams catches the eye of the tired-looking Chinaman standing back there and gives him a little wave and a smile. Huang nudges the JAG lawyer with his elbow.
Did you see that? Did you? She waved at us. A big smile and she waved at us.
Pierce says, confident little witch, isn't she? Huang whispers again.
You don't understand.
Then clarify it, Doc. The games are about to begin.
The sheriff is more than just confident,
he says, recalling the look on her face.
She's taunting us. She's telling us that no matter what happens today, it's all going to come out in her favor.
Pierce says, that's news? Staff Sergeant Jefferson is pleading guilty.
No, it's more than that.
Huang says, desperately trying to keep his voice low.
Remember our stay at the jail last night? When the jail attendant told us that she heard the DA had pissed off the sheriff by getting that guilty plea? That humiliated her. She's not a woman to be humiliated.
A door at the far end of the courtroom opens, and an older man with snow-white hair and wearing black robe slowly comes in. The woman clerk calls,
All rise!
Huang whispers,
Alan, I think she means to kill the staff sergeant.
Chapter 90, Afghanistan.
Once my eyes adjust to the gloom of the bunker's interior, I see five men of various ages and beard lengths staring at me. Four of them sitting up against a rough rock wall with AK-47s leaning against their knees. The one without an automatic rifle is minding a little gas stove that is heating up a kettle of water. A sixth one, who disarmed me earlier, is about to go through my rucksack. Electric lamps illuminate the rough interior, and dirty gray blankets are hung in two places, probably leading into other portions of the observation post. Fly strips dangle from the ceiling, dead flies attached. My breathing is starting to ease, my left leg actually doesn't hurt as much as it should, and I'm leaning up against a folded-up gray blanket. The man with my rucksack opens up the top, takes out a plastic bag, grunts, and holds up a fistful of Hershey chocolate bars. The men laugh. I say, go ahead, laugh. Bet you clowns have never tasted chocolate in your life. The man with the kettle pours the hot water into a teapot, gently stirs it. In perfect English, he says,